Good morning or good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call with Dan Blumenthal. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. The JPC has increased the number of outstanding speakers we're planning to bring you since we figured you're all working at home, and we're pleased that the number of listeners is increasing with each guest. So let's get right to it. As most of you know, your phones are muted during the program, so I don't have to ask you to turn off your cell phones. But if you want to ask a question, you're welcome to do so. Send your questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest today, Dan Blumenthal, Director of Asian Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on East Asian security issues and Sino-American relations. Dan has both served in and advised the U.S. government on China issues for more than a decade. He's been Senior Director for China, Taiwan, and Mongolia at the Department of Defense, and a commissioner on the congressionally mandated U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, where he held the position of vice chairman, and is a visiting professor at the U.S. Naval War College. He is co-author of An Awkward Embrace, the United States and China in the 21st Century, and Strategy in Asia, the Past, Present, and Future of Regional Strategy. His work has appeared in The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, Washington Post, Foreign Policy, and The National Interest. Most important from our point of view, Dan has written for us here at the JPC in our magazine In Focus Quarterly, and I've been an avid follower of his. But the piece that got my attention this time was called Coronavirus and the Future of U.S.-China Geopolitical Competition, What We Know So Far. So Dan, what do we know so far?
Well, thank you very much, Shoshana, and to all of you coming in. What we know so far is it's extremely imagine that China assumes a new role of leadership or prestige for a number of reasons. One is that the Chinese leadership, the Chinese Communist Party, made matters worse when the pandemic was spreading in Wuhan, in a city of about 11 million. They made matters worse by not reporting that they have a pandemic on their hands, by silent doctors who speak out publicly to warn that there was coronavirus throughout Wuhan, and also by silencing others and lawyers who knew what was going on, then also by waiting for very long to make a declaration to the World Health Organization until November 31st. And when they did make the decision, they said that it was containable and under control, and didn't say very much at all about the fact that it was human-to-human transmission. In the next couple of weeks, Wuhan is so big, just to give you a sense of the scale, it's about 11 million people who live there. It's a travel China. This was also going on during the Chinese New Year, so people probably in the hundreds of millions are traveling back and forth throughout China. Scope of how many people may have left Wuhan after the declaration to the WHO, it could be in hundreds of thousands of people, with untold numbers already infected, who went not just throughout China, but into Bangkok, Thailand, New York, Sydney, and other places. And the Chinese response, which I think getting probably too much credit for, was a classic sort of Chinese Communist Party response, which was to send the military to Wuhan and try to enforce an 11 million person quarantine and use other methods of social control and so forth. Not to say that it didn't work, that they didn't get the incidences down, but poll was very large, and by that time it was spreading so much throughout the world that the epicenter was no longer in Wuhan itself. So that will undoubtedly, what happened will be looked at extremely carefully by the U.S. and eventually other governments to try to hold China to account. One, first and foremost, so pandemic of this nature and of this scope could be prevented. It did not show leadership on China's part, showed quite the opposite. Since that time, the Chinese have engaged in misinformation campaigns against the United States. I'm sure many of you are aware and are trying to use a really massive global media propaganda apparatus that they have to say that they are being the most responsible actors on the world stage. They certainly are sending equipment and masks and so forth to Italy and other areas, but it's by all measures, by all indications, they're exaggerating how much of that is aid versus sales and how much of that equipment is actually working well and so on. So they have a huge problem at home. I should add what I just said, that while our economy will certainly suffer and you know, there's no doubt about that, the Chinese economy is going through some devastation this quarter. I was just reading economic numbers in China that said analysts are cutting growth numbers for this quarter in China down to level behind since 1966, since before the reform and opening began. And you can imagine why. Part of it is people not going to work. Part of it is slack demand in the U.S. and Europe. So while the U.S. is a much bigger, more dynamic, more market, a much more market-based economy that is going to go through some hard times, China was already going through some hard economic times before this and is now facing really devastating economic numbers they will have to deal with one way or another. And they're in no position, again, to be all of a sudden having international aid in very substantial forms, or they're going to have to face some difficult questions about how they spend fiscal resources in general as they go into more debt to try to get out of these economic hardships. So number two, I would say, besides they're not going to emerge from this better because of the fact that they made the pandemic worse in and of itself. Number two, I would say, is tremendous economic hardship ahead for China. Now, what does the Chinese Communist Party usually do, say, in times of crisis or trouble? There's no evidence throughout their history, going back to Mao Zedong and Xi Jinping as an admirer of Mao Zedong, that China just looks inwards and takes care of the human and economic toll within China. But more often than not, they have to distract the population through the most nationalistic actions they can possibly take, and they're doing that. So they are keeping the pressure on Taiwan, taking some very forceful and provocative actions around the Taiwan Strait in the last few days. And the pressure, there were reports today on the South China Sea, on Vietnam, encroaching upon some of those Southeast Asian countries, maritime rights and territories as well. So they're not, just like Russia, they're not sitting back and trying to lick their wounds and address all people's problems. They need a distraction. And the other distraction, of course, is to blame the United States and to try to take advantage of the fact that the U.S. is on its heels and so forth. So there's no doubt that the Chinese will seek to portray themselves as a quote-unquote leader on global issues, global health issues. But it's going to be very difficult for them to sustain that when people actually, the crisis starts to stabilize in the West, and people actually start to, either through their own governments, like in the United States, the Senate and the House, do their own inquiries into China, of which there are proposals for many, or more global inquiries. It's going to be hard to sustain the propaganda narrative that China, A, acted responsibly, B, will continue to do so. And it will be very difficult for China to muster the fiscal resources to really act like a global leader. Now, all that said, the U.S. just can't sit back. The U.S. obviously has a crisis it has to deal with internally, but it can't sit back and just allow China to propagate these narratives and so forth. The U.S., I believe, has to do a much better job in public diplomacy and information diplomacy, highlighting what it is doing and what it's going to do on international relief efforts. And that's everything from the fact that it already is a much, much bigger contributor to the World Health Organization and other health organizations than China is, and already has much more direct bilateral medical assistance programs with many countries dating back to the Bush years, before that, but in the Bush years with AIDS funding, malaria funding, and the Ebola fight a number of years back. The U.S. has to go, it can't sit back, it has to highlight these things. It can't just, it's engaging, the State Department's engaging in a sort of tit for tat about how the virus began. It has to pivot, in my view, to start talking about the efforts the U.S. is making and will continue to make in terms of organizing international relief efforts for countries that can't afford relief on their own. So we track the global competition with China will continue. My own thesis is China can't match us. They can pose huge problems for us without ever coming up to our wealth and power. And they can pose huge problems for us, both in terms of looking like a global leader, but also in terms of the risks they pose like this from mismanagement, without ever catching up to us. And I think increasingly, that's what the U.S. is going to have to deal with. The policy problem for the United States is you have a country that has really great ambitions right now, has more power and influence than it ever did, but has huge internal problems, and will be frustrated because its ambitions can't be met, and will export their threats, their power and security threats just as much as they export their problems, like not being able to deal with epidemics. And I think that's what we'll be facing for a very long time. I'm trying to see, I could stop there. That was a few minutes and open it up to questions.
Well, we have a lot of those.
Okay. Why don't we do that then?
Great. Thank you. That was a really good overview. We have a lot of questions. Ladies and gentlemen, we will not get to all of them. We've tried to call out the ones that have the broadest implications. So the first question, Dan, is, given China's control of information, do you think we'll ever actually know the origin of COVID-19? Is there any chance that it was a germ warfare lab accident or even not an accident?
It's a great question. And I and my staff have been really trying to track down the nature of the virology lab in Wuhan. It seems plausible. Even the scientific literature in the United States says it is plausible because they do work on COVID viruses inside that Wuhan lab it's plausible that there could have been some transmission. The biological lab safety in that lab is apparently, people have been warning about it for a while. So it's plausible that a bat or some other animal they used to experiment got into got into the animal market, the wildlife market. And that's something that that scientists and epidemiologists back here are trying to track. I am very doubtful we'll ever get a clear answer about that, about how to, how the infection itself got into the wild wild animal market. And also recall that this is the third such coronavirus originating in China in the last 17 years. So we do, you know, we do really need to get to the bottom of it. We're not, we're certainly not going to get to the bottom of it with the current WHO head, who is, has his job in large measure because of China. So information problems, other problems, I think getting to the truth is going to be very difficult. We're going to rely a lot on Chinese truth tellers who are risking their lives, you know, to get information out.
So you've answered another question in the course of this, which was how reliable are China's own statistics? But that question morphs into another one. How extensive and how dangerous are China's influence operations in the United States and in the rest of the West, trying to convince us that it wasn't them, that it was us?
Well, I think they're very dangerous also because, as we've seen, there are a troubling number of Western writers and politicians and so forth who actually, mostly unwittingly, I mean, no one wants to be a tool of Chinese propaganda, propagate these themes themselves or carry China's water. This has always been a problem in China's policymaking, in U.S.-China policymaking, which is that China has a massive propaganda apparatus. It's a pillar of the state's survival, and the U.S. you know, U.S. media and U.S. politicians and business elites parrot the same lines just because they hear them so much. So, you know, things like, well, what good does it do to assign blame, or let's not call it Wuhan virus, or let's not call it the Chinese virus, and so forth. And so they're effective. They're effective in deflecting blame. I think they're less effective in, and you know, I think they're less effective, and they realize that in saying things like the U.S. Army started it, even the Chinese ambassador disavowed that statement. But they are certainly effective in more insidious ways, and in getting the United States divided and distracted, and blaming each other rather than having the focus entirely on China.
I think we saw that with the Soviet Union in years past, and maybe we need to think about it in terms of China. Another question, two people that JPC members are familiar with, Michael Ledeen and Stephen Bryan, wrote recently that the U.S. is losing to China in quantum computing, quantum cryptography, and nanotechnology, none of which I understand, because so many scientists in U.S. university and research labs are Chinese, and China underwrites these efforts. Nanotechnology apparently being one of the world's most important new military technologies. So the question is, should the U.S. government impose limits and restrictions on Chinese participation in U.S. education and U.S. citizens educating Chinese people?
Mm-hmm. Well, the U.S. is just starting to do some of that. So the Justice Department, for the first time, has a China initiative. And you've all probably read about the Harvard chemistry professor and others that summit. These were not Chinese nationals, these were U.S. nationals. MD Anderson in Houston, who have been arrested for covering up the fact that they're taking Chinese government money, which of course has very big strings attached to it, to conduct certain areas of research and you know, collaborate with certain Chinese government sponsored labs. So I think we do have to be much more careful and scrupulous about what migrates back to China scientifically and technology, particularly with respect to anything we can identify that strengthens the Chinese military. And that is not too hard to do. Our intelligence services can identify those labs and companies that feed right back into the Chinese military. I don't think it would be a good idea and I don't think anyone's proposing to do so, to end scientific exchange or have Chinese nationals not come here and do science and so forth. We do benefit from certain areas of scientific collaboration, but I think the right direction in terms of cracking down on known programs to fund and then in some cases to just take U.S. know-how and bring it back to China. And I think that'll continue as the FBI and the Justice Department learns more about these various programs the Chinese have had in place for years to illicitly gain U.S. science and technology.
Thank you. You mentioned that China is becoming more aggressive, playing the nationalist card, given the problems that they have at home. In the South China Sea, regarding Taiwan and other expansionism, do you see any possibility of actual military clashes between the United States and China in Asia?
You always have to be prepared for actual conflict. Neither country wants it. The Chinese are trying to exert as much force and coercion as possible without triggering a full-out conflict with the U.S. It's what people are calling gray zone operations. It's the use of technically non-military vessels to conduct coercive campaigns to regain territory and so forth. It's the equivalent at sea of what the Russians did in Crimea with the so-called Little Greens. So trying to stay below the threshold of a full-out U.S. military response while still using force and coercion. But again, that's a tricky game. Eventually, if China does go too far, let's say on Taiwan or all kinds of things could happen in terms of when you're using that much military exercise and military forces demonstrations. And it's fairly militarized in both the Taiwan Strait and the South China Sea. The U.S. has been pushing back recently. So you always have to be prepared. The U.S. military is increasingly preparing for that type of conflict and rather than the conflicts it's been in the Middle East for so long. But everyone's aware of the catastrophic effects also because both countries are nuclear powered and intertwined and the economies will sink. And so I'm not too afraid of an all-out conflict. I think this pushing and shoving is going to be more the norm.
Thank you. A question. The Chinese government's attitude toward dissent indicates aversion to even small challenges, let alone large challenges. What have Xi and other Chinese Communist Party officials concluded regarding Hong Kong's prolonged and large-scale resistance to dominance from Beijing?
Well, I would say that there's a general lack of creativity in Beijing about how to deal with these types of protests. So let's take Hong Kong and Taiwan as two examples. So, Hong Kong, I think they thought that these protests would just die down, that they could elicit the help of the Hong Kong business community. It'd be too disruptive. They fundamentally misunderstand the nature of these democratic movements and how much people will sacrifice to stand up for their basic civil and political rights. So they've been experimenting with both carrots and sticks. They backed down on the initial issue that caused the tension in Hong Kong, a law that nobody wanted. But they have been using and eliciting the use, leveraging the Hong Kong police and security forces more and using more violence. And I don't think they have a very good answer, except they just hope, like a wildfire, it'll die out. On Taiwan, they don't know what to do. You know, the Taiwanese, you know, against China's best efforts to try to stop it, reelected a more independence-leaning president, and by large numbers. And, you know, the Chinese government feels like they're just losing control over political outcomes on the island. That poses a bit of a dangerous situation because the Chinese are probably concluding that all they have left is force and coercion. Now, that's not to take away, you know, that the Taiwanese are very brave in electing who they elected, despite political interference and media interference and so on. But the Chinese are not exactly creative in their attempts to stem the tide of these democratic, and these democratic movements, and they're not, you know, and they just don't abide by them. They just can't. To them, you know, those are great, great threats to their legitimacy.
So that goes along with questions about Chinese rule inside of mainland China. Xi overturned the party's guidelines restricting the leader to 2 5-year terms. Is there no significant challenge inside of China either to him or to the party? Is that over?
I would not say it's over. These things are extremely hard to follow and track and predict. As we saw in the case of the Soviet Union or the Arab Spring, or, you know, everything looks stable until the second it's not anymore. What we do know is that Xi Jinping is making a lot of enemies inside of China. So his massive anti-corruption campaign when he first came to power in 2012 was a purge of powerful political enemies, and he broke the sort of mafia-like rules they have in China, which is that the elites inside the governing Politburo have absolute immunity for their bribery and corruption. He actually broke that rule and arrested and detained people who had served in the Politburo before. So he has made enemies in terms of other factions, powerful factions inside the Chinese Communist Party. There are business elites in China that are unhappy with his economic policies that have led to slower growth rates, unhappy with the trade war. People are trying to get their capital and their children out as much as they possibly can. There's capital controls. So he certainly has opposition. It's just, at what point will that opposition coalesce or be able to actually challenge him? Right now, he's done a pretty good job of neutralizing them and demanding loyalty and purging cadres who he believes are disloyal.
So that works at the upper echelons of Chinese society.
Yeah.
Could you talk then about China's social credit system of surveillance and ways that it keeps regular people in line? And couple that with, do we have any idea how many people are political prisoners in China?
We don't have good numbers on political prisoners. It's high, particularly after efforts at social control with these detention and concentration camps in Xinjiang. It's even higher in terms of Muslim Uyghurs. But the social control mechanisms, the social credit system, whereby Chinese citizens are given scores on how loyal they are to the Chinese Communist Party, is quite sophisticated. They use artificial intelligence and facial recognition and certain biologics and so forth to track people and to see how, quote, well they're doing. On the other hand, there's some very sophisticated Chinese dissidents and Chinese people who get around Chinese social control movements. There's interesting articles and essays that are posted and get out into the West as well. So there's quite a bit of dissident behavior outside the party, you know, as well as you know, as well as worker protests that are underreported and so forth. So so it's a cat and mouse game, is what I would say, and the Chinese have to expend more resources to play it.
Is there a way for the United States to help those dissidents without obviously aiming for regime change in China and invading China or whatever, but is there a way for us to assist the voices of dissent in a reasonable way?
Yes, there is. And there's certain U.S. groups that work on that, even though it's getting more difficult. So National Endowment for Democracy, Freedom House, a few other groups work with Chinese dissidents to get their messages out and published to the West and get Chinese language broadcasts into China. There certainly can be a lot more of that. Right now, U.S. policy isn't so focused on that. It's focused on trying to change China's external behavior. But there's certainly, at least we're keeping the funding for things like the Voice of America and the broadcasting associations, and we're funding our own quasi-government NGOs like the National Endowment for Democracy and others. But there's obviously always a lot more we can do, and there's reasons to do so, both the pressure on the Chinese Communist Party, but also to get to know people who, in the case of a crisis, would want to be able to talk to, you know, in case there's a real governing crisis.
Thank you. Question. Kissinger and Nixon played Beijing against Moscow in the Cold War. We smoothed China's admission to the World Trade Organization in the Clinton administration, and always we expected China would, if not become more friendly toward us, at least become less aggressive. First question is, do we get China? And second, to what extent is China a competitor, and to what extent is it an enemy?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot in that question, and do we get China? I think not yet. I mean, I think there are more people in the United States now than there were 10 years ago who are attempting to really get China. But I think we got so much wrong from, now you can argue the Nixon-Kissinger opening at the time was, there was no choice given the fact that the Soviets were stealing a march on the United States and the fact that the Vietnam War was raging and so forth. But some of the other assumptions we made later, I'd say from the 90s through 2017 or so, that if we engaged China and enabled it to become a part of all international organizations and so forth, that they would change and moderate their political and economic and military behavior, I think was just flat wrong. I mean, that really showed that we didn't understand China. We didn't understand the Chinese Communist, the nature of the Chinese Communist Party, which would see all those efforts ultimately as a threat to their rule and would fight back against them. In terms of competitor versus enemy, you know, they are a competitor. They are a rival for geopolitical influence in Asia, but increasingly throughout the world. They have global ambitions that they've stated quite clearly since 2016, 2017. They're projecting military and naval power throughout the Indian Ocean and into the Gulf, into the Persian Gulf. They have a base in Djibouti, in a military naval base in Djibouti. And they're eyeing more along those oceans and waterways. So it's increasingly a global competition for influence and a global ideological competition too, because the Chinese want a world order that's more hospitable to their system of government and their what they call the socialist, you know, model, the socialist Beijing model, which is more state control of the economy and so on. It is a global competition, but China is so deeply entangled, I should say the Chinese people are so deeply entangled with the world, as we saw with what happened from Wuhan, that it's one of the most complicated national security challenges we've ever faced, because it's not simply a competitor. It's much more than that.
Thank you. So as we're looking to the future, and you've done a wonderful job of pointing us in the direction of the future, I can't tell you how much we appreciate that focus as opposed to the everyday focus on how many people have coronavirus. But as China faces the future, does it face a birth dearth like Russia and the Western European countries? And if it does, how will that impact their ability in the future to be a major international player?
Well, they definitely face a problem born out of the one-child policy that was started in the late 1970s, and it's a dual problem. The first problem is that before they get rich, because they're not yet rich per capita, they're wealthier as a nation than they ever have been, but compared to other countries that are getting old fast, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Western Europe, you know, even the United States in some ways, they don't have enough money to pay for the old without enough replacement workers. And so they're facing higher wages as the workforce begins to slowly shrink. They're going to face a tsunami of old age without the social safety nets in place for dealing with that. By 2030, 10 years from now, their demographics will look like Europe. It's hard in terms of more senior citizens versus working age population. It's hard to grapple with that because China's for so long has seemed like this young ascendant dynamic nation, but it is getting old fast. The second problem is probably well known to everybody, which is that there was a preference for male babies. And so there was an enormous amount of sex selective abortions that if they were going to have one child, they wanted a male child. So there's a large surplus of males, increasingly of marriage age, which is almost sort of science fiction to think about the consequences of that. Males probably at the lower end of society who can't find wives. So you're already seeing increases in social problems from bride theft to sex trafficking to different kinds of diseases. And it's just very hard to play out what other sorts of scenarios for U.S. national security that might lead to. But it's a real problem.
Is that a potential that those young men who can't find brides and start proper, what we consider proper, you know, adult lives, is that a potential revolution problem? Is that an unrest problem?
It is definitely an unrest problem. And it's an unrest problem also because it's going to exacerbate the deep inequalities in Chinese society. And the inequalities are exacerbated by the levels of corruption. So most Chinese, it's hard to make generalizations, but many Chinese, I think, rightfully believe that many of the very rich got so through untoward ways. And, they'll be married and in some cases they'll have more than one wife, which is not uncommon now in China. And males at the lower end of society will be unmarried and unhappy and not employed and so forth, not gainfully employed. So it's a huge issue of unrest. But you could see all sorts of scenarios playing out, from creating a militia to put down unrest to creating militias to take over territory. This is an issue that has not been thought through enough, not by the U.S. government and not by analysts outside the U.S. government.
So that leads to what I think will be our last question. do we have, does the United States have the skills and the diplomatic capability to build a coalition, particularly an Asian coalition, to stand up to China on some of these things that are important? This could be construed as a political question about the president or Democrats or Republicans. Please don't. It's a general question. In an open society like ours, where people spend a lot of time screaming at each other, do we have the diplomatic skill to do the things we need to do?
Not yet. So I think that we're just coming to grips, and we just have been coming to grips over the last few years of the scale of the China challenge. And there certainly are, just anecdotally, there are a lot more younger people going into the field of China and Asia with great language skills and so on, and responding to a demand signal, who will also want diplomatic careers and other types of careers. But it's a generational problem that we're just beginning to address. And again, it's a challenge like we've never seen before, because I'm not saying containing the Soviet Union was in any sense easy. But the difference here is that there still are many businesses that profit inside China. Maybe that'll change over the course of the next 10 years. There's still many stakeholders in having a close relationship with China. So to get it right and to think about how to contain the worst elements and the worst risks that China poses in under these conditions of deep enmeshment is extremely challenging. So it's going to take us a while, I think, to develop those skills and to come up with the right balance.
Thank you. And on that note, Dan, let me say on behalf of those who have listened on this phone call and those who are going to listen when we post the podcast on our website, thank you, thank you, thank you. You've given us an awful lot to chew on. Some of it optimistic, a lot of it not so optimistic, but all of it worth pondering as we formulate what I think will be new relations with China. We appreciate you.
Thank you very much for hosting this.
Our pleasure.